I'm going to officially get this thing started here. Welcome to the DTV Conversion Roundtable, the second to last roundtable of the conference. Thank you all for coming. Thank you for to our panelists for coming and being a part of this conversation. Just as a reminder, I know you've probably heard it a million times already. Laura, the co-moderator, is going to do a brief introduction of everybody. We'll give each of our panelists 5 minutes to state their position, so to speak. Let them chat amongst themselves, and then we'll open it up for a general discussion after that. So without further ado.
All right, I will give a brief bio. Actually, before you guys give your opening thoughts, you could just state your name again so we can kind of try to remember you. That seems to help. So this is Mitchell Pinechip?
Yes.
Okay.
You got it.
He is a software developer, media producer, political activist, and game show aficionado. As a longtime organizer with Chicago Media Action, Mitchell has worked on CMA campaigns around the Federal Communications Commission and corporate media concentration, public access television, public radio and television, community internet initiatives, and network neutrality, and U.S. digital television transmission. And we're happy to have him. He is also our convener, and he wrote the question. To his left, we have Philip Sewell, who teaches at University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he teaches media history and criticism and specializes in television and new media. His dissertation, The Substance of Things Hoped For, Quality, Cultural Authority, and the Realization of U.S. Television, explores the evaluation and standardization of television through the varying definitions of quality used by inventors, regulators, producers, industry executives, critics, and audience members. Actually, to his left is Brian Seebach, who received his PhD from UT Austin and is currently a lecturer in the RTF department here. His research focuses on convergence in the media industry and new media technologies and the political economy of contemporary Hollywood. Next, we have Bill Kirkpatrick, who is currently a visiting assistant professor in the communication department at Denison University in Granville, Ohio. His book manuscript, Airspace, Localism in American Thought and Media Policy to 1941, explores ideas about the local in American cultural and politics and their influence on the growth of the U.S. media systems. And finally, we have Bill Stotesbury.
Stotesbury,
spent I apologize.
Too much time working on it.
I know. All right. This is really just a linguistic test. He is CEO and general manager of KLRU-TV, Central Texas's PBS station, serving an 18-county area covering more than 600,000 households. Before joining KLRU, he led marketing, sales, and public affairs teams at several technology companies and was co-founder of one of Austin, Texas's first high-tech public relations firm. And he received his master's degree from the LBJ School of Public Affairs at UT in 1987.
All right, let me go ahead and read the question so we're all familiar with where we're starting from. In February 2009, analog television broadcasting will cease and be replaced entirely by a digital signal. This issue has received little mainstream coverage, particularly in terms of what citizens will need to do to adapt to this change. What opportunities could result from the conversion to help the public and further their awareness of critical media issues? Is this a way to promote wider media literacy? What should concerned citizens and scholars do to position themselves to take advantage of these opportunities?
Well, I should actually amend the statement slightly. Not all analog television broadcasting in the United States will cease on February 17, 2009. It will be the high-power broadcast signals. Low-power signals have in recent months have received a kind of extension from the FCC to broadcast for at least the next 3 years. So this is actually, strictly speaking, a not wholly accurate statement, but nonetheless, a clarification that should be mentioned. But nonetheless, what will happen in about 5 months' time is very real. And so what I will do is I have released a position paper, which I've outlined some of my thoughts on the matter, and which I'd like to read for you now. The digital TV conversion in the United States could well set the stage for a disaster and an opportunity. Some 50 million people in the United States still use over-the-air television, most of whom are poor, elderly, or don't speak English. Thus, broadcasters and the government are asking millions of people to make the leap to digital who can't afford it or who are unable to for one or a number of technical or logistical reasons. And where TV for many poorer communities still remains a key source of news and information, and actually another survey released just this week bears this out yet again, We could see many communities lose a source of information, widening the digital and informational divide in the United States, or worse. The two agencies in the U.S. government tasked with the conversion, the FCC and the NTIA, the Federal Communications Commission, and the National Telecommunications Information Administration, have no plan and no leadership to address the conversion. There's actually a government study that revealed this fact. Money is being spent, but per capita, compared with other digital conversion efforts internationally, the amount is laughable. The National Association of Broadcasters has promised some $700 million worth of TV time on public service announcements announcing the conversion and encouraging viewers to act. But that amounts to a one-time investment of 1% of the industry's annual profits. And since only 13% of public service announcements air in prime time, and PSAs comprise just 0.5% of all TV airtime, the effort is, in a word, piddling. Plus, precious little action, comparatively speaking, beyond these token PSAs have been carried through. The lone major DTV conversion test held just last month in Wilmington, North Carolina, amounts to a false positive, since 92% of the community does not use over-the-air television in Wilmington and in the five-county area where the test took place. And Wilmington broadcasters left the analog signal for a month after the shutoff deadline. In fact, it's actually still on. The entire U.S. will be asked to go cold turkey, and a number of analysts and even FCC commissioners have termed the transition in stark terms: a train wreck, a fiasco, a tsunami, and, as FCC Commissioner Michael Copps termed it before a congressional committee, the mother of all consumer backlashes. Whether or not this is all Chicken Little alarmism or a legitimate matter of historic proportions, we won't know until February, and maybe not even after that. But if we assume the latter, as evidence seems to suggest, there is also some very real potential here for some positive outcomes. On the media front, broadcasters and the very politics of media could face a degree of public scrutiny and a level of public interest perhaps unparalleled in American history. And that is no small matter. In 2003, in the wake of a controversial FCC media ownership rule rewrite, an unparalleled 3 million people responded to that rewrite, exceeding the previous high for responses to the FCC, which had previously been at 5,000. So you're going from 5,000 to 3 million in a fairly short amount of time. The scale of that response directly fueled political action that ultimately overturned the rewrite, and that overturn actually still stands. If the numbers and this assessment are anywhere close to accurate, we could see a scale of public response and perhaps outrage what could be 15 times larger than that of the uprising in 2003. Amid the public outrage that could well arise, a rare and extraordinary window of opportunity to improve policies that affect television and, by extension, all of American media is coming very soon, and concerned citizens and scholars would do well to prepare to seize the opportunity. A host of proposals for improving television and the media, which were long considered off the table, or at worst unthinkable, could well be brought into play. These proposals can include, but are no means exhausted to, the following. One, tax the commercial broadcasters by perhaps a fraction of a percent for use by the public, for use of the public airwaves. Idea number two, tax the advertisers and marketers who air on TV by a fraction of a percent. Idea three, take the billions of dollars raised annually through those proposals. You would generate a huge amount of money, even by a fraction of a percentage of tax, into a public trust to help galvanize funding for networks of public service broadcasting and public service media in the United States. Idea four, improve standards for license accountability, which could include revoking the licenses of one or more commercial broadcast stations or networks to reassign to public interest groups or broadcasters. That's not inconsiderable. In the entire more than 70 plus years of history in the United States, broadcasters have lost their licenses a grand total two times. One in Mississippi in the course of a racist broadcaster, famous WLBT case, where the station was actually lost its license after a legal struggle that took 7 years. And another broadcaster in Lansing, Michigan, which actually, technically speaking, lost its license, but actually still got to keep the station for reasons I won't go into here. Idea number five, reassign the multitude of new digital TV channels that the commercial broadcasters are currently and plan to hoard to reassign to public interest groups or initiatives. Concerned scholars and activists have a role to play here. New ideas will go nowhere without the political muscle to make them real. And indeed, the DTV conversion and its political aftermath could help unite those disaffected by major commercial broadcasters. And those could include poor communities, communities of color, those who don't speak English, and the burgeoning media democracy movement, which has seen very substantial gains in recent years. They can all join in coalition efforts to win one or more changes. And I believe that scholars and activists should do a various number of tasks to assist in this and other efforts. What I've said is just but one perspective, and one, my answer, but not the only one, to the matter of the DT conversion at hand. And so I would like to extend to the panel here their perspective on this matter and the issues at play, and look forward to responding to them and hearing your thoughts as well. Thank you.
Thanks. I'll go next. I'm going to somewhat read the paper and somewhat talk through the paper here. The conversion to DTV provides media scholars some opportunities to engage in historiography as well. It allows us an opportunity to interrogate some of the cultural logics that have been expressed, some of the regulatory values that have been expressed since the late 1920s by the FRC and then the FCC, and to look at why it is that we regulate television, why it is that we think that standards are an important thing. Standards ended up being defined in terms of the interests of the market as early as the very early 1930s, when mechanical television was not allowed to be commercialized, and this was because mechanical television was thought to have a deleterious effect on the market for higher definition television that was just around the corner, and eventually came in 1939, and then of course had to be then pulled back off the market and reconverted into the NTSC standard, and then had to be reverse engineered so that we could have a bad color standard that was backwards compatible. So we had this set of values that emerged, and one of them was backwards compatibility for the protection of RCA and the major manufacturers eventually, and also for consumer protection. But the definition of us as consumers rather than as citizens is implicit in that set of regulatory values that starts to get expressed there. And here we have, in some ways, a train wreck that also gives us the sort of opportunity to use, as historians, a potential train wreck, I should say, to use this event as something of a particle accelerator and see what the subatomic particles that make up our regulatory values are, and think about new ways to spin them together into interesting new configurations, as you've suggested. And I just want to conclude by saying that it allows us to really start to hold up some interesting questions about the logics that have dominated our regulation. So have we over or undervalued stability? And I think that's a really important question. How and to what ends have we defined quality and used quality as a tool to enshrine a particular notion of what broadcasting should be? And why do we, as owners of television, not have more of a say in what goes on in television? And I want to conclude by just saying that, in many ways, in talking about standardization in terms of the preservation of markets and making economies run well, it leaves out the question of standardization being justified in terms of television being something that we share. And for me, that's one of the things that I think is a real opportunity here, is to rearticulate television as a shared cultural property by all of us. And so I'll go on to you.
Great, thank you. I'd like to thank everyone for coming and for the panel as well, for everyone for being here. What interests me partly about this panel and about this process of the DTV conversion is not only the technical and regulatory aspects of it, but the opportunity as media scholars for us to study the campaigns that are being designed by the FCC, their efficacy or lack thereof, and the degree to which, as scholars and as citizens, we can offer some feedback to improve the FCC's efforts. So I'd just like to take you through some of my paper here, and which might give you a good sense of where the FCC is at in terms of their outreach efforts. And then sort of problematize those efforts and suggest some questions, at least, for altering those efforts. So on August 18, 2008, FCC Chairman Kevin Martin announced that five FCC commissioners and other commission staff would embark on a nationwide outreach effort to educate consumers leading up to the DTV conversion in February of 2009. The program, which features an ambitious plan to visit 81 cities, offers the opportunity to engage a variety of publics in critical media issues. However, these publics and the depth and scope of the message being offered to them appear limited by poor event planning strategies and by the complicated nature of information pertaining to DTV conversion. The official website for the FCC's DTV Consumer Education Nationwide Outreach Tour identifies six groups designated as most vulnerable in the transition to DTV. seniors, people living in tribal and rural areas, people with disabilities, individuals with low incomes, minorities, and non-English speakers. The first two visits by the FCC feature presentations made at local Alaskan consumer electronics retailers, a senior center, and a public library. While it's not immediately clear what the turnout was like at these events, given the press coverage of these happenings, it is clear that little effort has been made thus far to offer in-person information services via these events to more rural areas and non-English speakers. All of the events took place in English, were presented in English. Furthermore, the inclusion of two major retailers, Best Buy being one of them, as sites for presentations combined with information sessions being held on weekday mornings offers very little room for optimism as to the efficacy of the initiative. So the point there being that some of these publics might not be readily available to go to Best Buy's at 10 a.m. on a Tuesday. According to the FCC, markets were identified for outreach based on statistical models and demographic analyses. Only those cities with 100,000 plus households, or at least 15% of households relying solely on over-the-air broadcast signals, were included in the effort. Events were to be supplemented by an increase in PSAs on radio and television. PSAs, information about this, PSA is now running on cable and network television in most markets, attempt to offer basic information about the switch to DTV. For more information about the conversion, consumers are directed towards the FCC's website. Again, broadcasting these PSAs on cable to audiences without cable is kind of illogical, as well as, this idea to direct those presumably without digital television or without cable television to a website for more information is kind of interesting and sort of brings up, the FCC's perspective on the digital divide and who these people are and what their access to media is. However, nowhere on any of the FCC's information pages is there an opportunity to view information in a language other than English that I can find. Nowhere is there information for disabled consumers. Nowhere is there information geared towards senior citizens. The ironic nature of the lack of efficient communication strategies deployed by the Federal Communication Commission notwithstanding, it is difficult to imagine that this outreach program will serve as anything other than a public relations outreach effort. So something that they can say, hey, we simply tried. While the FCC has offered any number of tools to aid in the conversion efforts on their website and their outreach toolkit, these tools fail to solve the inherent problem of reaching those demographics identified previously. So they offer banner ads and countdown clocks for websites, and those might be effective in reaching a small sampling of the desired population. And there's also a huge set of YouTube tutorials by consumers who are sort of pointing their cameras at their conversion boxes and really offering sort of basic, like here's how this functions type of thing. The FCC has failed to adequately identify strategies to reach consumers needing the information most. As citizen scholars, we are afforded the opportunity to write some of these bureaucratic efforts through our own outreach programs. Properly located and scheduled events can serve the public good by offering information on media technology and the switch to TV signals. Locating these events at neighborhood community centers in the appropriate language would go a long way towards engaging key demographics. Consumers, once offered the basic answers on the switch, may in fact be interested in the minutiae of HDTV versus SDTV, or the rules governing broadcast versus cable pertaining to the DTV conversion. In fact, these events hold the potential to create grassroots awareness of the purpose of the DTV switch. Information about multicasting could indeed be of some value. Consumers could be offered access to information about the auctioning off of the airwaves after the conversion to wireless and internet media conglomerates, which, could be useful for people to know. Mm-hmm. While the opportunity exists for promoting wider media literacy, it is evident from the early stages of the FCC's outreach plan that governmental outreach is simply not effective enough in accomplishing its goal. Citizens not already engaged in the information cycle relating to this subject will undoubtedly be left with brass tacks knowledge needed to make the television operate post-transition and little else. Thank you.
Bill Kirkpatrick, and I think it's interesting that this is called the DTV conversion panel. You just called it the transition. This distinction between transition versus a conversion has all this sort of religious symbolism involved to it. And it raises the question of exactly what is being converted. And there are a lot of things that are being converted here. I mean, what we're talking about is the conversion of analog to digital, but it's converting, as Philip's paper sort of suggested, it's converting television into something that's a little more cinematic. It's converting affiliates who had their one signal into these kinds of nodes of localism through which they can perhaps unite diversity and localism in interesting ways. There's this whole problem of localism being, you know, you can't serve the entire community, you can't even know the entire community, and certainly they can't do that even with, you know, an additional 4 to 6 signals. However, it does allow affiliates to perhaps find new intersections of a diverse community and a diverse localism through its programming, et cetera. My particular interest is in how it's converting citizens and viewers into policymakers. And here the idea is that policy, we study policy, we think about policy as this kind of official top-down thing that governments do to us, more or less in collaboration or cahoots with the industry. And it becomes this kind of thing that is delivered from on high, and it either works or it doesn't work. We either go with it, it succeeds, or it fails in its primary mission. And I think this represents a fundamental misunderstanding of what media policy is, how it works, how we need to think about it. And so I take the digital conversion moment as a way to think through how citizens themselves are creating media policy, how they're responding to it, how they're translating it, how they are implementing it according to their own priorities, needs, et cetera. And I have a few examples. One is the one that you brought up, which is these YouTube videos that just citizens are helping to translate this policy that the government admittedly has not done such a bang-up job at communicating. But they're acting as policymakers. They're acting as policy translators and taking that information that they have and conduiting it through to others. A couple of other examples. One would be that Hawaii is asking to go a month early. The reason being that the analog towers are sites where the dark-rumped petrel nests, and they're afraid that the conversion in February is going to mess up the nesting cycle of these birds, and so they want to go a month early. And it's kind of an interesting situation where they're taking this official top-down policy and trying to work with it for local conditions and translate it into something that works locally with other priorities, in this case, a very admirable environmentalism. Another example would be, what do we do about prisons? Right? There are no coupon codes for coupons for prisons, and yet, are they not cultural citizens too? Well, are they? Ohio, for instance, proposed setting aside budgetary funds to make the conversion happen within prisons, it was roundly, you know, scorned and mocked, and that's what we should be spending on, And yet it does raise these kind of problematic ideas of, are they cultural citizens too? And if so, what kinds of media policies apply to them? Last example would be people who take these coupons, take them down to Best Buy, get their converter boxes, go home, come back the next day, return the converter boxes for $80, and then spend it on something that they really want or need. And the feds have attempted to stifle that with various policy things, but those moments of official top-down policy, you cannot use these for anything other than converter boxes, you cannot return converter boxes for cash, et cetera, that only works if there's a policy translation moment at this point of sale where the clerk at Best Buy has to know about it, has to give a damn, right? What they do with their money and their coupon codes and so forth. The last point then to make is that, is sort of echoing what you said, which is that we too are policymakers, right? Mm-hmm. We too have a stake in this policy and can act as policy translators. So for instance, come January, my broadcast history class, I admittedly live in a very small town, Granville, Ohio, 2,000 people. But part of my broadcast history class will be a service learning project where they have to go out and knock on doors and explain to the community what's coming up and how that's going to work and how it affects them, what they need to know and what they have to do. And that's something that can be applied more broadly. So just to summarize then, policy is not this top-down thing that the government has failed to adequately establish. it's something that I think happens at multiple levels, and recognizing that and turning citizens into policymakers is in many ways a beneficial outcome of this sort of road to Damascus thing that we are facing.
I'm Bill Stotesbury, and I'm sort of in a bit of a different position, I think, on this panel, in that I'm not, don't pretend to be a media scholar by any stretch of the imagination. I became involved in all of this about 5 years ago when I became general manager at KLRU after 25 years in the technology industry. And my greatest qualification probably was I've been a frequent and constant television viewer since I was about 3 years old, laying in front of the television trying to do my homework and other things as a kid. And having stepped into the position that I'm in about 4.5, 5 years ago, one of the first things I was confronted with was this whole notion of a DTV conversion. The first thing that occurred to me was, as the months went on, I thought it was interesting that they finally set the date for the DTV conversion, not as part of a more comprehensive media reform package, but as part of the Budget Reduction Act, the Deficit Reduction Act, which says something about what's really motivating the priorities given to this particular policy area. And I think part of the reason why some of the issues that the other panelists are raising arise, that is that there are lots of issues that haven't been given adequate thought in how this moves forward. Being part of a station that every day is answering a phone from people who are calling with questions about DTV conversion or digital problems, we're finding lots of interesting things, like the fact that the boxes perform very differently. And as the FCC has enforced its policy and begun to work to get the boxes diffused, there really hasn't been adequate testing of different boxes. And so we have different performance levels now that we're having to deal with from viewers. Just one small issue. That said, though, I still have kind of a Y2K vibe about this whole thing, which is I think at some point we're going to get to February 18th, and there will be disruptions and dislocations in lots of parts of the country, particularly among people in rural areas or people who live in valleys or that are in kind of topographically challenged areas. But eventually I think those will be resolved and the transition will occur. Barring a catastrophic event that happens, at the same time that switchover, the issues of concern about people using television for emergency information and other kinds of more catastrophic notions, I think, ultimately will prove to be less important than the senior citizen who misses Lawrence Welk because of the conversion, which was something else I learned when I took this position. Don't preempt Lawrence Welk. This is a particular issue to public broadcasting stations because the Association of Public Television Stations has estimated that among our audience, because our iconic viewer is 55 years old and upwards, public broadcasting viewers are 48% more likely than the general population to obtain their signal over the air. And so these are things that we're troubling over. But the reality of our day-to-day life is we have to trouble all of them in the context of some other things that are occurring. And I want to take a minute to just touch on those other things, then we come back to them. Number one, we're worrying about DTV conversion at exactly the same time that we're also worrying about the trend toward video delivered over the web becoming increasingly probably the most compelling change in broadcasting in the last many, many years. Broadcasting and video content are no longer restricted to the square box in your living room. It's available on your iPhone or your mobile, or it's available on your computer. It's available in lots and lots of different places. And that concept of video over the internet is not only an important concept for me as a consumer. I'm a Lost nut, so when I watch Lost, I don't watch Lost on air. I watch Lost at abc.com. I do it because it's more convenient for me. And the quality of the viewing experience, while maybe somewhat degraded from what I can see on my HD set in my media room, is nevertheless perfectly adequate for what it is that I want most of the time. Which says that people want to watch content where they want to watch it, when they want to watch it, and at a level of quality appropriate to their particular need and desires. I think it was Philip made the comment before that quality is sometimes used as a way of enshrining a particular perception of broadcast. And I think that's a critical concept because among my own guys, the technical guys that work for me, the biggest impediment to moving effectively into the creation of a new channel for delivery of content on the web are the engineers who are concerned that if we go anything below the resolution that they're used for in the production of studio work or, you know, high quality field cameras were somehow demeaning the god of broadcasting. Meanwhile, everybody with a cell phone becomes a broadcaster by putting it up on YouTube, and the stuff that we call crap out there on YouTube and other user-generated sites are pretty soon giving way to a whole new concept of user-generated journalism that now is even being embraced by Kevin Martin, who's out on these DTV trips, trying, you know, talking about localism and asking that local broadcasters encourage non-traditional journalists in their investigative models by once again recommitting to, you know, these new forms of news delivery. Well, that's a, I think that's an enfranchisement of this new model that I certainly wouldn't have predicted a couple of years or a couple of months ago even. A second trend that I think we have to understand is it's also occurring at the same time in a lot of battles over the retransmission negotiations on the retransmission battles are occurring. And if you guys are from Austin, you know, if you try to watch The Office on Thursday night, you're going to get some crappy kids movie from Starz instead on your Time Warner Cable Channel 4, and that's because of a nationwide battle. It's not just Austin going on between Lynn Broadcasting and Time Warner, in which Lynn Broadcasting wants money for its signal. Not an entirely unreasonable thing. Content should have some value, but yet Time Warner has refused to pay the money. Again, not an entirely unreasonable concept because they don't have to pay most other people for the content at the primary tiers that they come forward with. That said, Time Warner has called Lynn's bluff and pulled them off the channel in lots and lots of different places. Secondary effects, for those of you who study economics, are always fascinating, and one of the secondary effects of that has been that the demand request for coupons going into NTIA and the coupon distribution from markets where Lynn has had its channels pulled from the Time Warner station is going much up much faster than in markets, other markets where that particular externality hasn't had an effect. And so Time Warner really views this as an opportunity to a certain extent to take a stand, to reach out to people and to say, we're going to stand up for you because you shouldn't have to be paying for content, and if Lynn makes us pay, then you'll have to pay as well. I don't have a lot of sympathy for Time Warner to a certain extent, although, you know, they carry us and it's important to us, because they're in the process of taking our second channel, KLRU 220, and taking it off of channel 20 and just putting it on channel 255, which means that anyone who wants KLRU 2 is going to have to pay to have access to it. They did it without ever sending us a note, not an email, not a smoke signal, nothing. Found out about it because one of my employees looked on the Time Warner website and saw it. So those retransmission battles that are going on and kind of the reassertion of control by the cable industry and the reality that the cable industry views this as a marketing opportunity, as does Time Warner with, you know, UVerse and its IP, or rather AT&T with UVerse and its IPTV based, is an important part of this as well. And the third thing that I think is happening at this point that is really critical is the FCC's emphasis on localism and how that combines with the opportunities that digital TV and online TV offer for multicasting and alternative delivery models. You know, in one sense, you can be very excited about it because it represents an opportunity for democratization of content delivery that, you know, lots of people think would be really great. And I think that's basically our attitude. Our notion is we've got to develop a hyper-localism strategy that incorporates the digital channel on the web into what we do as part of our responsibility as a PBS station. At the same time, the commercial channels who may try to move down that row are going to find themselves pretty soon under the reality that that kind of hyperlocalism generates certain dangers. If you really democratize your channel, then you're opening it up to people who have vastly different views than you or your advertisers, on whether it's on that channel or on other channels. And I suspect that rather than the phenomenon of multicasting, meaning the increase of more local content in response to FCC requirements, it's going to instead be the proliferation of direct feed channels that come in from some secondary source that are based off in some other part of the country, whether it's retro TV or, you know, other kinds of prepackaged channels that are going to come from down across the multicast. I think the affection for localism will fade as the impact of localism really begins to hit the commercial stations. That said, I think it still is a tremendous opportunity for public service broadcasting, whether it's public broadcasting or others, to do some amazing things in the incorporation of user-generated content and the broader interactivity and conversation that this allows to grow up between broadcasters and their audience if we do it well and we do it with quality. So as we look out at the DTV conversion on a day-to-day basis, the things that concern me less are what happens on February 17th, because I suspect that what will happen is our phones will ring and our engineers will have to work to try to help people and figure out it's not just the box, it's also the antenna, and it's not just the box and the antenna, it's where your signal is and how deep above your valley is, and lots of things we'll have to deal with, and we'll be prepared to deal for that. The bigger issue, the tougher issue for me, is what the competitive implications of this movement of new forms of video delivery, of the battles between the cable channels and between the cable providers and the satellite providers and the commercial channels might portend for us in terms of blowback on public broadcasting and public service broadcasting, and finally how it is that we're really able to realize our public service mission in the light of all of these changes. I think that becomes the thing that's the most, that keeps me awake at night.